From the Lynn to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the sixth day of February, 2026. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Giovanni Prezzafontes will join us to discuss how you can use conservation tillage in the fall in front of your corn crop, and then we'll turn around, talk about the weather forecast too, and that corn crop soybeans as well, and what conditions might be like in the United States going forward, and Argentina and Brazil as well. We'll do that with Eric Snodgrass on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It was an interesting week in Chicago. Context will be important, but first, don't forget to purchase your tickets for the All-Day Ag Outlook. It's coming up the third day of March. That's a Tuesday. The cost is just $40. WillAg.org to make those purchases. In Chicago, corn and soybeans, old and new crop, all settled with outside up weeks. Mike Zuzulo now joins us from GlobalComResearch.com. He is in Atchison, Kansas. Hey, Mike, thank you for being with us. It's been a while since we've talked. I appreciate you not being with me because I took some vacation time and I just had a ball while we were in New York City and Boston. My wife, Claire Ann, and I went there. However, by the time I arrived back to go on the air Thursday yesterday, a whole lot had happened. Can you tell me about how you saw this last, I don't know, 5 to 7 days in the marketplace?
Yeah, I mean, it was a big week because we had for a second week in a row a lot in the soy complex, a dramatic, you know, price. I guess I would classify it, Todd, as a price determination shift. What moved the markets? And we went from fundamentals to start the week with Argentina, Brazil, exports being too expensive at our Gulf versus South America, things like that, back to policy again. And we had the 45Z announcement from the U.S. Treasury that really didn't get us anywhere after one and a half days as far as bean oil led rally. And I put that to the point probably because it was a mixed reaction in the biofuel industry. So the trade didn't sink its teeth into that, but it did really sink its teeth into the second policy move. And that was President Trump announcing those Chinese purchase increases from 12 to 20 million metric tons for U.S. beans. That essentially took us from 1050 March futures to 1140-ish. And in November, it took us from about just under $10.70 to just over $11. Notice, though, on Friday, I think we went back to more of an issue of maybe buying the rumor and selling the fact because we had not gotten any validations from China in terms of press release, nor had we gotten any physical bushels purchased in U.S. export sales. And we're recognizing we're bumping up against Tuesday's WASDA report. And so I put that as 75% of the market with the bull spread very active in beans. The other 25-30%, though, is probably the most disconcerting. We didn't see the wheat and corn really follow the beans very well at all, except on Thursday. And it was a very out of sync market as we closed the week. We had a lot of reasons to go higher in the outside markets. Gold back up 4%, silver up 8%, equities new all-time high. Dollar was down, crude was up, not much, but we had the makings of coming back around. And I would say net-net, agricultural futures, both grains and cattle, were pretty disappointing on Friday's close. So we don't want to slip into a sentiment shift here, and that's kind of what I'm getting at with the funds. I'd like to see a really good Monday in terms of a closing market.
So by that, you mean the January final reports is kind of the tone we're set with still?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this is where, you know, at the end of the day, we're buying beans and selling corn right now because of this news, not as much in the new crop, but we're just making our beans more expensive. And we do have the Supreme Court coming back on Feb 20. And I would expect that they will probably talk about the tariffs. And so I think President Trump's policy, and, you know, I don't know this. This is my analytical mind working. But I think President Trump and his people are very aware this is the base crop insurance time for figuring for crop insurance for corn and beans. And I think they're making policy moves to try and keep the futures market well supported. Will WASDE, will South America, will the Supreme Court allow for that support to continue. And that's where I'm very much in the camp of doing short-term hedges on new crop beans, and did some more 25 sales. I've got about 10% more left to sell in 25 beans, but was really thankful for the rally. But it's just, are we on thin ice or not?
Yeah, so I know that you must have looked at the calendar for the Supreme Court, see that opinions next time are due on the 20th. I kind of thought that they would come again sooner than that, but they're not until then. That, and they may or may not come out with an opinion. Hopefully they'll have, I guess, an opinion. Who knows?
Yeah, there's a lot of writing. There's a lot of writing in Washington saying the exact same thing or suggesting the same thing that you are, is what's going on? Why the delay?
Right, yeah, and we don't know. South America, the drought you discussed there, looks like there might be rainfall that takes care of some of that. Do we know how badly the Argentine crop has been hurt, corn and/or soybeans, and how much of a difference it really makes?
Yeah, I think we do know more and more, and I think this might be why the meal market gave us some support to us late in the week, and why I was also disappointed with the corn. And because in states like the provinces like Rosario, the 30-day precip has been less than 30% of normal, and we're talking about 100-degree temperatures. In Buenos Aires, that's that province, looking at 30-day precip levels of about 55-60% of normal, and very hot, dry conditions there. I'm picking up that we've got in some areas of Argentina, if these expected rains, as you know, don't come through, I've got expectations that we'll see some 2012 type looking corn, like what we had in 2012, be seen in some of the key provinces of Argentina. I would also suggest that the what I've seen in the models, both private forecasters and what I look at myself, as the models are in very much disagreement. So not a lot of rain the next 5 days. It's supposed to really come on though after that. That's going to be I think, a big piece of the puzzle with the WASDE report in terms of the supply demand fundamentals, not the policy fundamentals next week.
Anything else before I let you go?
You know, I would say this, Todd, that there's a bigger and bigger disconnect between cash wheat and corn, and it's getting wider and wider. Near 3 month highs in Russian wheat, near 3 month highs in European grain cash markets, and 3 month highs when it comes to, or 2 to 3 month highs in Ukrainian corn prices at the export market. Is that war? Is that supply? It could be a combination, but there's something of a whistling past the graveyard in the futures market, it seems to me, in Chicago versus what's happening out there. So I still very much feel like the corn market's got some upside to it.
Hey, thanks much. We'll talk with you again next week.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great weekend and have a nice Super Bowl, buddy.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's at globalcomresearch.com in Atchison, Kansas. There's a new article on the Crop Central website. You can find that by searching Crop Central, comma, illinois.edu. It should be one of the first things to pop up, sometimes called the Bulletin. This one's titled Evaluating Soybean Performance in Conservation Systems, a Project Report. Giovanni Prezzafontes is the lead on it. So you were looking at soybean production and different ways, for instance, no-till, conventional till, strip till, and cover crops involved, I think, in just the no-till portion of it. Can you tell me why you looked at those and what some of the outcomes might have been?
Sure, yeah. So, you know, when we think about soil erosion, right, either by wind and water, conservation practices such as reduced tillage and cover crops, they are well established, right? So we know there's a body of work in the literature showing they're very effective at reducing soil erosion. And not only that, but there's also many other we used to call agroecosystem benefits from those practices, right? So you're keeping the soil covered for most of the time. If with the cover crops, you know, there's evidence that they're helping suppress weeds, breaking past disease cycles, improving nutrient cycling. Cover crops is a big component of our Illinois nutrient loss reduction strategy. There's a lot of work that shows that we can reduce nitrate leaching losses and tile drainage with a grass cover crop. So we know all the benefits, but then when we look at adoption, it's relatively low. My student, Federico Roll, he's the one leading this project with me. So he looked at the USDA and Illinois Department of Ag data on percentage of no-till fields in the Midwest and Illinois. So just focus on Illinois. We can see that the percentage of no-till cropland, it's relatively low. It's about 15% on corn and about 35% on soybeans. And again, we know the benefits, but I think when I talk to people, there's this, perception that these practices are somewhat risky, mainly because they're often associated with potential yield penalties.
You took a look at five different fields in Illinois and Iowa. What did you find?
Yeah, so again, we looked at different combinations of tillage systems with starter fertilizer. So a total of 12 treatments, just to briefly list them. So we looked at conventional till. It's a two-pass, right? A fall chisel with a spring cultivator. That's what most people are doing. Then a strip till in the fall, a no-till, and a no-till with a cereal rye cover crop. Each of those systems were paired with a starter fertilizer strategy. We also have an untreated control where we don't have any fertilizer. We had a treatment where we applied nitrogen as UAN and another treatment where we applied nitrogen plus sulfur as a blend of UAN and ATS.
Once you've done that, really what we want to know is how well the soil stayed in place. But also for this, we're looking at the economics of production, isolating just the tillage portion of this and the things that are surrounding the different methods. Did you come up with a net return of any sort? And I know it'll be a partial net return because it doesn't include anything, but what did that net return look like, and which practices held up best?
Yeah, so just quickly before we get to that, we did see some early season responses as we would expect to see. Like on average, the soybeans that receive starter fertilizer, they tended to look greener and they produce a little bit more biomass early in the season. We took soybean samples early in the season, mid-season, to kind of see how they perform throughout the season. We did see those early season effects, but then at mid-season they kind of disappeared. We took tissue testing at R2, and by that point we did not see any significantly difference in, and we looked at nitrogen and sulfur concentrations on those tissue testing that we did. And an important point here too is that when we look at those concentrations, they were all above the critical level that we often see in the literature. So the data pretty much suggests that, by that time, mid-season, the soybeans, they were not nitrogen and sulfur deficient, even the ones that we did not apply nitrogen. When we look at yields, again, even though we saw those early season starter fertilizer effect, that did not translate to yield. So meaning that we did not see any yield increases when we had the starter fertilizers, but we did see differences in the tillage system practices. So on average, across six sites in 2 years, we saw that basically we were able to maintain soybean yields when we moved to some of those reduced tillage practices. So there's a figure four in the article. If you look at the average yield, statistically, we did not see any significantly differences among the conventional till, the strip till, and the no-till. We saw a slightly lower yields when we had the no-till with the cereal rye, but numerically that was just like 2 bushels compared to the conventional till. So they all average about 60, 76 to 78 bushels to the acre.
And when you put down just the brass tacks, because no-till didn't have a cost related to tillage, and the others did, honestly, the no-till, once you took the gross revenue, might have had a lower gross revenue than both strip-till and conventional-till, but once you take out the cost of doing the tillage pass, it did better.
Exactly, yeah. So we used like those cost of tillage that our colleagues in the ag econ right? So they have this handbook with the College of Field cost of tillage presses. So again, we only did this as a partial net return. So we were only taking into consideration the cost of the tillage, right? So if you look at the partial net return, we did see higher returns with no-till, and exactly as you said, just because there is no expenses with no-tilling, followed by strip-till and conventional-till. We did see the lowest partial net return with the no-till with the Syrah rycover crop, and that was mainly associated with the higher cost associated with cover crop management.
And that would have been the cost of the seed in the past to get it on.
Exactly. So yeah, planting, cost of planting seed and termination and estimated at $55 per acre. Versus strip till, for example, is estimated at $26 per acre. But again, we try to make the argument that, we know there are, and farmers know, right? Everything we do in the field costs money. We know there's a big push for cover crops. We know the benefits and why we're promoting it. But again, I think this is something that farmers usually ask me a lot on the economic side. So again, this is just partial net return. On this, but it gives an indication that some of those conservation practices may come at an additional cost, and I think there's need to be some discussion there. There are a lot of state and federal cost share programs that can help offset some of those costs, and I guess I'll just leave those conversations to the ag economists.
That's Giovanni Prezzafontes. He is an agronomist in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. You may see this research online, the article that he's penned. It's titled Evaluating Soybean Performance in Conservation Systems, a project report. It's in the Crop Central website, the bulletin. Just search it out, Crop Central and Farm Doc Daily. Let's take a look now at what's happening in the world of agricultural growing regions. Eric Snodgrass joins us. Hi, Eric. Thanks for being with us, of course, with Nutrien Ag Solutions. I'm wanting to know about the cold weather that we have had and the warm weather that we have today. 37, 40 degrees feels pretty darn good at the moment, I suppose, even under cloudy skies.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on my way through Peoria right now as we're talking, and the car says it's 43 degrees outside. I left my jacket at home, honestly. I have like a quarter zip on, and it's plenty nice, and it's such a far cry from where we have been. So what's going on here is that the second half of January up until about 2 days ago has really brought in some Arctic air. It's come out of the Arctic, Todd. And while it's been so mild and so dry in the West, but now we're starting to see a little bit of a turnaround in that pattern. It's going to replace all this incredibly dry air that we've been dealing with better chances of moisture. And if the jet stream starts to make the turn and come out of the Southwest, Todd, we could start to work against the dryness we've experienced. And even though there's snow on the ground, you got to understand something. There's not much water in that snow. And below it, the subsurface soil moisture issues are still lingering from fall's drought. So I would like nothing more than to warm up and get some rain on top of this. And there's better and better chances as we go toward the middle of the month that we're going to see that.
We are behind. And while the folks in the South are talking about being, Southern Illinois, that is, about being dry. It's really right where we live is kind of the center of how dry things have been. You think mid-February really can change things up for us?
I hope mid-June too, Todd, since you dropped that in there. But no, I do. I think there's more and more evidence that as we go into the second half of February and then get into March, April, we're gonna see a quick revival of soil moisture. If it doesn't happen, and that's always a possibility, we know that. If it doesn't happen, then that means a lot of these signals we're keeping an eye on right now, we really don't understand them. And what I mean by that is all of them are kind of pointing toward a more active Ohio and Mississippi Valley setup to finish this winter and start spring. And again, I'll give you some years to think about. The same 3 years I've looked at for a while, but this 2018, 2014, and 2009. And I think, Todd, that using those years to get us out of winter and into spring is probably pretty good advice on finding some analogs, at least a blend of those years. The question will be is once we get farther out into the spring, Do those years still hang on?
So, longer term, what are we hearing about for the United States?
Yeah, well, actually, our story in the United States might start somewhere in the Pacific, like the equatorial Pacific. And here's the new story. This just came out on the 5th, Todd. We have a brand new long-range update from the European model. And I'll be honest with you, I was a bit shocked to see that the model increased the likelihood of not just an El Nino, but a strong El Nino by midsummer, mid to late summer. And when you look at how the model is handling that, it's keeping much of the delta, the mid-south, midwest, including the Mississippi and Ohio River basins, very wet only through the Great Lakes into spring and summer. So based off of that, plus my analogs, I would say, hey, we do need to probably be talking about tighter windows. And Todd, in a month from now, when we're talking together over at the Beef House at your all-day ag outlook, I think it'll be much clearer at that point what spring may hold. So this back half of February will be very telling as we watch La Niña collapse and El Niño build, and then how all the little sub-seasonal features, kind of jockey position around that bigger factor.
We'll look forward to hearing about that in the growing season here, but really it's about the growing season in South America at the moment.
Yeah.
Argentina has been dry. Are they going to have some relief?
Oh, they already did. On the 4th, it stormed in Buenos Aires province, and then they had storms last night in Cordoba, Santa Fe, and then the northern growing areas. And right now, the forecast for the next 2 weeks, well, next week, it's looking really wet in some areas down there in Argentina. And Brazil, I'm waiting to see what the harvest progress looks like. They'll send out those numbers later on in the afternoon Friday. But I'm guessing since last week, they were double the pace of the average 5-year harvest progress in soybeans in Mato Grosso, but they will probably still be near the top of the distribution. Safrinha corn is going in a little slow. Maybe they made more, speed up this last week, but it was a little behind. That's something interesting to watch. But the reality, Todd, is that we are now entering the 8th straight week where the NDVI values across Brazil, that's plant health measured from space, okay, where they are now in 8 straight weeks of record high values. And so you have to imagine that the soybean crop coming out is as big as some of those estimates would suggest.
Indeed. Thank you much. We appreciate it. We'll talk with you again. Look forward to having you at the Beef House, too.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. I am looking forward to it as well. And hopefully you get a packed house there and we all get to enjoy some good cinnamon rolls, coffee, and discussion of markets, weather, and all the other good stuff.
All of that stuff. Thank you much. Folks can come and see you and the rest of the Farm Doc team, the Will Ag analyst at the Beef House. That is Tuesday, March the 3rd. The cost is just $40. It's a bargain for the day. You'll love it. Get yourself registered. You can do it on our website right now, willag.org, willag.org. But don't wait. I didn't start marketing this until, we're 3.5 weeks out. So just go ahead and get yourself registered today. Don't wait. And we'll look forward to seeing Eric and you at the Beef House. Thanks for listening to us here on the afternoon with the Closing Market Report. If you can stay with us, Commodity Week is next. If not, you can hear it online at willag.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.